You are now part of a social experiment.
Welcome to Mastermind, the show where you learn to develop and master your skill from the best of the best. Here's your host, Mr. G.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Welcome to our Black Thought University monthly segment. I'm here with our co-host, Professor Paul Robinson, and we are ready to start thinking. Today, we will be taking our focus to the Black fathers. We'll be talking about Black fatherhood. And don't believe the hype. We definitely have things that we need to work on. However, Black fathers are a part of their children's lives more than any other race. So even though we got things that we need to work on, there are still fathers out there holding it down, like the three Black fathers that we have today that will be sharing what they do for the village and what they do for the community and their own families. So today we have Brother Shamari, who is author of Why Our Children Hate Us, How Black Adults Betray Black Children. And he's a radio host for Word Radio, one of the few Black radio stations in the country. We also have Mr. Nasheed Ali, a.k.a. Pop Pop Grow Something, who's a storyteller for peace and a social worker that has served the Philadelphia community for decades. He helps Brother Shamari with his groundings program through storytelling and interviewing guests every Sunday at 6 p.m. on Word Radio. Mr. Ali is also part of Keepers of the Culture, a group that aims to preserve Black culture and identity through the African tradition of storytelling given to us by the griots. We also have Dr. Onaji Muid with us, who is also a social worker. He's also a human rights activist, community organizer, violence preventer, mental health advocate, and of course, an advocate for the Black family. He's also the fatherhood coordinator for Healthy Start in Delaware. Welcome to the program, gentlemen. It is an honor to have you all on the program. Let's go one at a time. Brother Shamari, how you doing today, sir?
Greetings, Mr. G. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. Looking forward.
Indeed, indeed. Mr. Ali, Pop Pop Grow Some, how we doing?
I'm all right, Mr. G, and I'd like to give a shout out to Brother Shamari and Dr. Onaji. Peace to everybody on the panel.
Speaking of Brother Onaji, Dr. Onaji, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing very well. I got my family from Staten Island. You see T2L, right? True to life. I got my Staten Island family here. So I'm really happy to see that, that they came through for me like that. And also, brother, I haven't seen in a long time, Brother Olin. So yeah, ask me how I'm doing. I'm seeing all my people, you know, on the screen. I'm feeling fine, man. Feeling fine.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us.
Mr. G, I want to give a shout out to Staten Island too. I visited Staten Island with Dr. Onaji, and I haven't seen him since that time. Since the pandemic, Staten Island, peace.
All right, I'm super excited, man. We have just a wealth of wisdom here with us today between the three of you guys and decades of experience as far as parenting goes and as far as doing community work in the Black community, man. So I'm ready to learn today, man. But before we get started, one of the special things that Mr. Ali does on the Groundings radio program, which is on Word Radio with Brother Shamari, is he starts off every Sunday program with a Black story. So today, if he can start us off with a story about the topic that we will be discussing today. So Mr. Ali, Pop Pop, would you mind doing your thing?
Why don't you hand me down my walking cane? I said, hand me down my great-granddaddy's walking cane. Well, hand me down my great-granddaddy's walking cane so we can walk and take a stroll down memory lane. That's called memory lane. And that's hand me down my walking cane. And I said, hand me down my great-granddaddy's walking cane because recently I had an accident and I have to walk with a walking cane. So it's coming up. We always had a picture of my great-granddaddy and he always had a cane. He was with my great-grandmama standing right next to her. And he had that cane. So as I was growing up, as I was a younger man, I always looked at this picture. And I wondered, why did great granddaddy carry that cane? So about a month ago, I had an accident and couldn't walk and had to have an operation, and I had a walking cane. And I took a look in the mirror. I had to take a look at myself. When I looked at myself, guess who I saw? I saw my great granddaddy. I said, wow, now I realize why great granddaddy had that cane. I called up my family and I told my family, I said, y'all, and I got a lot of family. I called up South Carolina. I called up Staten Island, my family in Staten Island, called up my family in Philly. I said, you know, I always wondered why great granddaddy carried that cane. And now I know, because I got a cane. So I looked and I thought about great granddaddy. And great granddaddy, a lot of us, especially these days, we time takes our family away. So we might not have the opportunity to be in the presence of our great grandfather. When I'm on Brother Shamari's show on WURD on Sundays, I always talk about my grandfather, Pop-Pop Grow Something. And Pop-Pop Grow Something taught me what my great granddaddy with that cane taught him. And that's how to tell stories and how to blow this heart. And every Sunday on WURD radio, I blow the harp and I tell the story in honor of my grandfather, Pop-Pop Grow Something. But his father, my great-grandfather, I had a chance to meet. I was small, I was 5 years old, but I was in his presence. And to be in your great-grandfather's presence is a strong vibration. Because everything that his father, my great-great-grandfather, taught him, he taught his son, my grandfather. And my grandfather gave it to me. And what they taught survival. Because the picture of my great-granddaddy was down south. I don't even think he left south. He had about 13 children. His children left. And his father, my great-great-grandfather, had about 12 and 13 children. And for the most part, they stayed together. Some of them, you know how we disassociate ourselves from the family. Some of them left. But most of them stayed together. So we know our generations. We know the generations. And we chronicle our family from my great-great-grandfather. He had 12. And then my grandfather had about 7. And all was passed down through the father. And the father was strong. My great granddaddy was strong. And I look at that picture today. And then when I look at me and that cane and I look in the mirror today, I can see my ancestor. And that's the same with us on this panel. That's the same with us listening. If you look, you'll see your ancestor. The older you get, the more you'll look like your ancestor. That's why when I go down south or anywhere I travel in the diaspora, I always look for people who look like me. Because our family got dispersed all over the place. So you don't know who's your family and who's not your family. Now, one time, we were vibing, the brothers got together and we were talking about fathers and grandfathers and great grandfathers. And I was learning because my father wasn't perfect. And I guess his father wasn't perfect. His father wasn't perfect. So we still learning. We still learning to be fathers. And a brother told me, he said, yeah, you a father and that's one level. But then when you reach grandfather, That's a whole different level because you're the grandfather. You got a son or you got a daughter and they got children. And your children come to you as granddaddy. So whatever you have, you impart to your grandchildren. So I take it that if you ever have the opportunity, and it's a blessing to be with your great grandfather. And like I said, with times like these, where they're wiping us away when you 18 and 19, life in the city don't even give us time to blossom into grandfatherhood or great grandfatherhood. Get all you can, because they have a lot of knowledge to impart. So these days, that's why I'm on the panel. These days, I just vibe off of my great granddaddy. On Sundays, I vibe off of my grandfather, because they are, and they imparted, I am today. Hand me down my great granddaddy's walking cane. And let me walk down memory lane. Peace.
Appreciate that, Papa.
You're right. All right. Fatherhood, thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, man. Importance of grandfathers and great grandfathers, man. Super important, man. That's generations and generations, man. And we also have another grandfather in the midst with Dr. Onaji. And I wanted to ask Dr. Onaji, just what his experience was coming up as far as fatherhood wise and what it was looking like. You know, oftentimes I hear, you know, people say, well, you know, the Black fathers was holding it down back in the day and doing this and doing that. And it was in the community. It was in the house. They was doing this and that. So Dr. Onaji, when you was coming up, man, what did it look like? I know you was in Harlem and a few different places. So if you could share with us your fatherhood experience coming up.
I'd like to thank Brother Nasheed for that beautiful sharing of his life and his heart, and it comes to mind is how so many of us don't have that kind of lineage. How many people can say that they knew their great grandfather? How many people can say they even knew their grandfather? So when he was talking, there was so much strength and power in that that it filled a void on me, a void in terms of I knew my father. Thomas Oliver, want to, you know, give him spiritual recognition of Abai. He's in the spirit world, died at 53. And when you think about it, the older you get, the more 53 seems just so, so young. In most religious traditions, 40 is considered the age of manhood, many religious traditions. So 40, he became a man. And he lived another 13, 14 years. It seems to be such a missing. I miss him. He was a very disciplined man in terms of going to work. I don't even know if only time he ever missed a day of work is when he had an accident and they wouldn't give him health insurance. So that broke his heart. So living, experiencing my father in his trials and tribulations, I understand why he drank. Didn't understand how his actions when he drank, didn't understand those actions, but I understood certainly why he drank. And then his father was also Thomas. And he died when right around the time that my father was born. So this missing I'm talking about, I'm hearing is in Brother Ali's sharing. And saying, man, I wish I would have had that, you know. But then again, I'll just end by saying there is such a thing as extended family. I think the two things that have helped Africans here in the United States survive is our belief, our spirituality, and also our extended family. I think those are two things that, you know, we play that in spades all day long. So I can talk about Baba Randy Weston, who became our adopted spiritual father, grandfather, you know. I can talk about brothers like that who've been in my life. So there was a biological missing, but not necessarily a sociological missing.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji. Brother Shamari, man, what is your piece, man? What was fatherhood for you growing up, and what'd you see?
Good question. So I was the only male. I grew up as the only male in my family. So I was the oldest child and the only boys with a single mother and two younger sisters. So I didn't have any brothers. I didn't have any uncles. I had my grandfather around, and I actually knew my great grandfather. He had a farm, 11 acre farm in Jersey, where we would go, you know, and gather as a family. So, you know, but he was, coming to find out later, he was my quote unquote step great grandfather. Those terms don't really mean anything, but, you know, when you find out later, it's just an interesting history. Absent would be the word, if I had to summarize it in the word, absent, feeling like you have to figure out everything on your own. And it's not until, you know, a little later on in your manhood journey that you understand what actually those voids are all about, what you don't, the foundation that you don't have, that you have to fill in for yourself when you haven't had that role modeled for you. And it's not until I became a father, and it's not until I become, you know, a baba in the village, whatever, you know, that the idea of learning by trial and error, because you don't have the role modeling and that social model foundation, that becomes very clear. And I think that, you know, in the society that we live in, I think that we know this, but we don't take it seriously enough, that there's a very clear bullseye on the father, the Black father. Not that it's the only bullseye, but the bullseye is on the Black father, because if you break that role, then everything else becomes easy pickings. I mean, that's just biology. That's just nature. And I remember, you know, people here might be too young to remember. I remember when growing up in the 70s in good times. And I vividly remember the scene when they killed off James Evans, you know, and Florida goes, damn, damn, damn. And it's like at the time, you know, I'm young, but I get that moment. And, you know, if you know, if you get a chance, go and really research the backstory of why they killed that character off. And this idea of, you know, Norman Lear never wanting a stable Black family in the beginning. So Florida Evans and John Amos and them are literally fighting to have themselves as a couple, and not to let this clown character, JJ, take over the dynamic, right? And there's this whole power struggle going on, and the resolution, because the white man, you know, a lot of what we see on TV in blackface is white people's stories about us that we're just acting out for them. He won the battle, and he literally killed off the character, you know? And I think that that's a microcosm of the reality of the struggle that we're in as a Black family. The bullseye, the you know, Dr. John Henry Clark says slavery was a war against African culture, but most specifically against the structure of the African family. And we are still in the midst of that struggle. And I think that the key to the resurrection of that, the resurrection of our power, is the restoration of the African family. And, you know, I just think that's something we got to take a lot more seriously.
Man, well said, man. I definitely got to look at that episode. Man, it's so interesting that we have three different Black fathers on and three completely different experiences, man. I didn't even plan for that. So fascinated, man. So I wanted to ask you all, when you initially became fathers yourself, what was that experience like for you? I know for me, I was like, I had no idea like what it entailed, what I was supposed to do, like anything. And I had to kind of go into this discovery mode. So did you guys have a similar experience, or, you know, what was your experience? How did you figure out your role as a Black father initially with your first child? So we'll start again with Mr. Ali.
I think when I became a father, and let me say that I have seven children. So I have seven children. So when I became a father, it was a discovery mode also, because, you know, even though I had fathers in my life, in my family, I had my natural father, but I had stepfathers. I had a stepfather. I had a natural father. So like Brother Shamari said, that bullseye is on the Black family. And the house that I was raised in didn't have cultural values. Cultural values embrace the village. It embraces us as a people. So you got collective values. So if you don't have the father in your house, you have the Baba of the village that you can go to. But I was always at confrontation with my stepfather. I remember coming up, one of the things that I laid down when I was about 6 or 7 that caused us to have a friction was the fact that I said, well, you can't tell me what to do because you're not my father.
Mm.
So he didn't like that. So we had a conflict from that point on, because it was always between us. So when I became a father in Philadelphia, this is when I embraced wholeheartedly cultural values. So therefore, I had to draw from the wellsprings of Black life. I had to draw from the Babahood in our cultural community. And they're the ones who set me down and talked to me. In the story, I talked about a brother who was breaking down the levels of grandfather and great-grandfather and father. But they also broke down, yeah, well, you gotta go out there and hustle every day. You gotta go out there and work every day, bring it home to your family. You got to raise your family. And I paid attention. So it was discovery of discipline with love, discovery of having the family together and not together. Discovery of everybody surviving together. So I managed with the, and I can't say that I did this alone. I had to, you know, give my wife credit, because that's part of the fatherhood. When we sat down and talked as brothers, a lot of brothers would say, you know, we would say, well, we like what you're doing with your family. And they would say, well, it's not me, it's my wife. So you got to, you know, always keep in mind us as a unit. It's discovery.
Got it. Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji. But what was your initial experience?
Wonder. I was 18, just graduated high school. And I was just so amazed to see this little baby at the crib, and had and have still a great love for my first child, Taisha. Very different circumstance, brother. Nasheed, I wasn't married, young, didn't know where I was going to go with my life, nor did she. We didn't stay together, but it was just wonder. And it so happened that I'm a drummer and she became a dancer. So some of my greatest memories of my beloved Taisha, who's in the spirit world, she left in 1996. But I can just remember when she was younger, I used to play drums for her, and she used to dance in the park, and just, it would be like heaven.
Hmm. Yeah, man. Sorry to hear that, man. What a difficult experience, man. Got me at a loss for words, Dr. Onaji. But what was your process in kind of maneuvering through that? Because you were 18 years old, man. You were still a baby yourself, you know? And we do find in our community that a lot of babies got to maneuver through that process of fatherhood and parenting. And, you know, they're worse off than us, man. Like, they don't have a job maybe, or they're struggling with money. They don't know what the future holds. Like, how did you kind of get into a point to figure things out a little bit?
I have to say, I'm not taking any credit for this, right? But I will say that my girlfriend and I, we broke up. We actually thought we weren't compatible. And when, and usually around those ages, you're not talking about marriage, you're just really talking about a relationship. I found out after we broke up that she was pregnant and said, okay, I got to make this work. And the reason that propelled that feeling was me and Jackie, you know, tried to make it as a couple, right? And all of the other young Black couples who are trying to make it, and there's so much stuff in the way. So this thing of fatherhood is me being a grandfather is taking in that energy that our young people are suffering. And then of course, how that gets translated to the child in terms of their emotional, their socio-emotional growth, how is that affected when the parents are not there, when they're having those kinds of struggles. So fatherhood for me incorporates all of your family, if you will, the extended family, the community, your people. And for us as a people to talk about fatherhood, I'm reminded of Malcolm X. I love this. Out of all the t-shirts I wear, this is one I like to sport the most, and I just happen to have it on today. It's a picture of Malcolm, El-Hajj Malikot Shabazz, and his, and two of his daughters. And it says, fatherhood by any means necessary. But on the back of the shirt, it says, fatherhood only means that you are taking care of your children. That's what it means to be a father. It doesn't mean having babies. Anybody can have a baby. But a father helps to raise his children. There's another word for fatherhood. It's called responsibility. So once I found out that, you know, my girlfriend was pregnant, I decided that let me see if I can make it work. And we lived together for a while, right? So I'm glad that my first response was that. And this is not judging brothers who go in different directions, because I think all that is contained inside of what is called the Ma'afa, a key Swahili word that means the great tragedy. We're still living in the Ma'afa. And our work as fathers, as grandfathers, as fathers, is how we pull ourselves together. Sometimes it's going to be through biological means, you know, your actual blood, or it can mean through extended family means. And I think that that's the only way that we're going to survive. And later on, you know, maybe we can even talk a little bit about rites of passages, right?
Yes, sir. That's in the plans for sure.
So I'll save that for later. But yeah, the first experience was mixed the love and wanted to accept the responsibility. But I will say this, I was young and very, very foolish. When other young people said, don't put your name on the birth certificate. And then the mother of my child agreed with it too. So we were both young and foolish, getting wisdom, we thought was wisdom, but it was foolishness coming from other folks who didn't know. You know, it was a grave mistake, you know, that never got corrected, but it's about us owning each other. We got to say who we are to each other, you know. My father, his name is Thomas Oliver, but that's his mother's name. That's not his father's name.
Right.
You know, and then when you look at all the families that has their mother's name and saying the father's name, there's this missing pieces, you know, we got to fill in the pieces.
Definitely agree with that, man. Thank you for that, Dr. Onaji. Brother Shamari, man, what was your initial experience, man? How'd you figure things out?
I don't even know if I figured things out at this point, bro. That's still a work in progress.
Appreciate that.
You know, I was a little on the older side, I guess, what people would consider, and I wasn't married, so I shared that with Dr. Onaje. But I was 28 when my first son was born, so I can't claim, you know, ignorance about a lot of things. I think for me that the biggest struggle was trying to find the balance between warriorhood and fatherhood, and what that's supposed to mean in the context of you know, I was a part of a lot of formations at that time, and I remember to this day, you know, a lot of brothers would say, You know, I got to opt out, man, because the most I can, you know, it's acquiring too much time. The most revolutionary thing a black man could do is to be a father to his children. I'm like, that's a good father. I don't know how revolutionary that is, but, you know, if you got to tap out, just tap out, you know, but don't try to rewrite the walk. And, you know, people may, and I would love to have a conversation about that, because I think that this idea of, you know, is there a synthesis that you can figure out, particularly out of the context of marriage, right? So I think that somebody like Bob and Malcolm X, because he was married and the queen he was married to, Betty Shabazz, they were in alignment, you know, you could figure out how to do that. But I think that when you have children and you're not politically, ideologically aligned with the mother or the father, the parents are not aligned, and then they're not together. And, you know, I just think that that struggle, man, is a big deal. So, that, you know, for me, that would be the context that I would grapple with my role as a father, both with my youngest son and now my oldest son and now my youngest son, who's 12. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, what's the dance? What's the rhythm that you can find when you are as committed to the warrior role as the father role? And when you're in a union where everybody's not on that same alignment, I just think that it creates a lot of trip wires that are hard to navigate, that I hope we get a chance to talk about more as a people.
Yes, Mr. Sir, G, can I respond to that?
Yes, sir.
Brother Shamari, yeah, that's been my struggle. And I tell you that I'm blessed because I got to resolve. My second daughter, Namibia, said to me one day, "Baba, you love the community more than you love me." Mm. Oh man, it really stuck a dagger in my heart. And now me and my daughter, in fact, are closer than me and my son. In fact, my son has decided to disassociate himself with the whole family, not just me. But if I thought there would be, if there was somebody sitting in a situation, who's going to be, you're going to be closer to your daughter or to your son, I would have said my son. And now it's the opposite. And we are very close, right? But trying to negotiate time and attention. And I think it has to be, like you said, Brother Shamari, a dialogue about that in terms of how I don't know if there's any greater challenge than being a black male revolutionary, because you want to be in all these different, but you see all the blight, you see all the places, you see all the empty spaces where people aren't and where they should be, and you're trying to fill in, you're trying to be with your niece, you're trying to be with your nephew, you're trying to be with your friend, you're trying to be with the friend who took you to the mosque to take shahada and his children, you know, as well, without a father. You're trying to be in all these places at once. And it is a master, that's called oppression. What is it called? It's called oppression. Trying to bring more people into the fold. So again, so with fatherhood becomes that education and orientation for younger people to balance that out. You know, my grandson, he's 31, you know, and I was giving him that same type of orientation about this battle between spending too much time over here. He hasn't gotten married yet. He ain't made me a great grandfather yet, but I'm trying. I keep pushing him, but the boy, I don't know. I hope he finds the right one soon. That's all I got to say.
got you, man. I appreciate
Mr. G, can yes, I comment also?
Absolutely.
You know, Brother Shamari was saying, and that's what was being said in Philly. I don't know about New York or other places, but, you know, we were dealing with revolutionary thought, black revolutionary thought. And it was the same thing that was presented to you was presented to me. You know, being a father and keeping your family was a revolutionary act for the black man. So you look at that and you see, well, because I asked, I said, well, why you say that? Because when we grew up, again, that target is on our back. So we grow up with these thoughts, this misinformation. You know, families now, we want to run through all the ladies. We want to make babies all over the place and not take care of our responsibilities. That was the line. That was the line until I got into the culture. And being in Philly, again, the brother stepped to me and said the most revolutionary act that a Black man can do is to keep his family together. And like Brother Onaji said, you can use Malcolm as an example because he had his children with him. I think even at the Audubon, they might have been there, but his family was there. You know, his family was right there. So that is a revolutionary act to keep your family together. And when I got my family together, I observed the other families in the culture, other families who I thought was intact. Because what we see and what goes beyond that may be a little different. But what I saw, they were intact. And I used them as a model. Because we, you know, being, and it's still in me, being raised in the family that I was raised in, it might have been men around, they might have been fathers, but that generation had its imperfections that carried over to me, that may carry over to my family, because fruit doesn't fall too far from the tree. That's what they say. So I hope not. I hope as time goes on, my family will heal itself from whatever illnesses I might have conveyed to them in my development.
Yeah, we can stay on this one for a minute. I hear you, and I don't know if we got time and space for the argument. I think there's a responsibility to parenting that begins even at the selection of the mate. I just think that that's something that, you know, it's easy to say now when you're old man and you're not as driven by that connection. But it's if you talk about rites of passage, man, we got to really have a tight rites of passage around the selection process of who you're going to mate with, particularly if you're procreating out of that mating, because we don't get that right so often, and the consequences we live every day. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, yo, we're a little, in my opinion, as a people, a little too cavalier right now about what is probably one of the most important decision you're going to make. Because the minute that happens, you are now bringing in a new life into a world. And the warrior in you says, this world ain't good enough for what I just produced. I got to fight to make it better. Similar to what Dr. Onaji said, you're seeing all these voids and you feel compelled to have to do something about that. And I'm not saying that women don't have this compulsion. I'm just saying I can't speak for the female energy here. I'm saying as a man and as a warrior, I see the world is, I was about to curse, messed up. And it's my calling to do something about that. And in doing that, it might compromise my ability to be, quote unquote, there for or as present for the child that I just brought into the world. And if you and if the mama and the baba are not on the same page and in alignment about that, that is going to cause confusion. And we are not structured enough as a village to reconcile that confusion well. So everybody's personal needs supersedes the collective needs in that moment. And that's where I see a lot of chaos going. And it crosses generations because we have not figured out how to heal that the right way yet, in my humble opinion.
Well said, man. Well said. Can I comment? Professor Robinson, of course.
Yes, sir. Just piggybacking on what you said, I had the same issue. I dealt with a woman who was not on the same page as I was on. I thought she was. And then I found out when we had a child that we were not on the same page at all. What I did was I gathered the village, and I was consistent with everywhere I went in my revolutionary capacity. I took my daughter. We didn't go in. If I went, she went. She didn't like it. She was not happy about it. But now we have a beautiful relationship. She said to me the other day, "You realize being free is not free, right?" And that was it for me, because I understand that she understands now what I have been trying to show her. But it was, you're right, it was difficult. But I do think the village helped me raise my child. The village, everybody knew her. If there was a move made and it wasn't supposed to be made, I knew about it. And she would look at those people and know that they were going to tell me. So she would tell me first. Although all those things, even the trauma, excuse me, that we talk about, it hurt. But I think because I was consistent and I made everybody else consistent, Uncle Norm up there, Norm Daniels, I made him consistent. He did the same thing. He had programs. I bring my daughter and other, it allowed me to also bring other kids in the neighborhood whose fathers were not around to those programs and do those different things and those rites of passage groups that we set up. And I turned babysitting into an after school program, because the kids were just hanging around and parents were not home until 5 and it was 2. And so those things, I think the village did help me, and it helped because I was consistent. I was consistent, and I caught heck for being consistent. That guy's crazy. What is he talking about? We're not going to do that. What is he talking about? We have to live with these white folks and we have to do this with them and blah, blah, blah. What is he referring to? And I would just take it, and I would be consistent. And it's not without, you know, wherewithal, but consistency was the thing that helped me the most with my daughter. My daughter has a basic understanding. If I taught classes in the summertime, I'd make her come sit in on those college classes, and she didn't like it at all. You know, it was summer. They wanted to be out hanging out, and we have to do this. And finally, she would call me, because eventually her mom moved away. Then she would start calling me and saying, "I can't believe that just this happened, blah, blah, blah." And she was able to identify the type of racism it was. She understood what she was supposed to say to people and what happened, the consequences of telling the truth. So it was a profitable experience for me. But I did use the community in that way, and that kind of helped me get through it.
And then, you know, maybe I need to take notes from you, because I, you know, and maybe Nasheed and others can attest. I consider myself as consistent. I took my son everywhere, and he hates that to this day. Like, to this day, he can't stand the fact that everybody knew him, and he went everywhere. So, I do think a big difference, though, and it goes back to the key point, is that, again, that misalignment between me and his mother. And I think, you know, it goes back to the modeling. What I would have to own is, and I think, you know, Dr. Najee was getting at this, when you're out there and you're feeling obligated to everybody and everything, sometimes you don't wear that well. You might be a little grumpy, a little mean, a little, you know, you're not. And I think that my son probably saw an unhappy revolutionary and said, "I don't want to be that dude." You know, and so, you know, in hindsight, and that's why I think that this is an important conversation, man, because, again, at the end of the day, we're trying to really resurrect the family system. And that energy that's flowing through that family system, man, has to be positive in order to generate a desire in our children to want to replicate what we're about. And if they see us as unhappy and mad and, you know, bitter revolutionaries, it makes sense that they're not going to want to be that, you know, when they grow up. Mm-hmm. So they're going to pick a different way that they think is going to bring some happiness and joy. And that's why I think this conversation has to really, like, if we're about bringing Black liberation and freedom and replicating that across generations, man, how do we get this family system dynamic right in such a way that is regenerating itself in a positive pro-social way? You know, I think about the Asar Aset Heru story. You know, there has to be an alignment there such that you can recreate, you know, through your children, the power of the resurrection and the restoration back into that kingship and that queenship. And that has to be a recurring cycle, you know, and you know, I just say personally, I don't think I did a good job. And I don't think collectively we as a collective family system have figured out how do we replicate our, into our children a desire to uphold the mantle of revolutionary fervor and carry that forward. We as a Black people have not figured that out yet.
Amari, you know, I'll take the baton. This is like a 440 race, right? Passing it up. So there's something, there's a Kemet word that's called Wahimi Misu. W-H-M-S-W, Wahimi Misu. It means rebirth. Before Europeans had this idea of the Renaissance, and the only reason they was in the so-called Dark Ages because we wasn't giving them the information. But Wahimi Misu is rebirth, but it's also a national program to revitalize and restore the culture. And the people who have been culturally oppressed, politically oppressed, we are in the stage of Sankofa, of going back and fetching it and returning to our traditional greatness. So the spirit of Wahimi Misu is all over the world at this point. And we are waking up to our identities. We're waking up to our purpose. We're waking up to our direction. And as we continue to talk, we're going to find that there's more of us that's more conscious than we think. We've been, because there's no place for us to kind of come together. It's like having a party. If you have a party with a big enough place, you can have a big party. But if you have a small apartment, you may not think it's other folks don't want to be at the party. No, there is a party going on. And we just have to keep on doing what we're doing. And like this, like right now, having this circle, there's a number of initiatives that's moving to create a national Black men's organization, the Conscious Black Men, who know that success can only be defined by what's good for me, what's good for my family, what's good for my community, and what's good for my people. Those four aspects have to be the definition of success that we can use and must use for us to find the collective strength that we need to actually create the liberation that we must have.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onanji. Man, like I said, man, it is a wealth of knowledge throughout, you know, these brothers here. I wanted to take the time to kind of decipher. I know you guys, everyone said they're still figuring it out, but you guys do have a wealth of experience and knowledge. You've seen other people do it. You've done your trial and error yourself. You've seen some of the things that work, some of the things that don't work. So from that standpoint, I wanted to dive back into the womb and decipher some of the best practices and things that we could do, you know, as Black fathers to support our families and our children and what we should be doing. So I know Dr. Onanji is learning to be a doula. So we're going to hit him up with the womb question into infancy, what we should be doing. And then I want Mr. Ali to tackle the children, what we do with the children. And then Brother Shamari can tackle what we do with the teens into adulthood in regards to how we should be fathering from that standpoint. So Dr. Onanji, while you are with us, if you could share with us from the womb into infancy, toddlerhood, what we should be doing as Black fathers.
Thank you. For those of you who may be hearing this word doula for the first time, it's a Greek word that I was told that actually means slave. Like, you know, I ain't down with that, right? So like the shirt that for Queen Mother Harriet Tubman, she said, I'm out. But doulos, the group I work with is called Doulos for Dads. And it's saying that the same way that men can be doctors and deliver babies, men can also be doulas and doulos and work with what is called a birth doula. But I'm being trained to become a postpartum doula after the birth, right? Now just think about it. If you look at all the scientific studies, it's been shown that Black women do better when they have a doula to help her through their process. And she does even better when there's a Black doctor. So where's the father? Where's his support along the way? I didn't even know there was such a thing as a male doulos until I started working as the father coordinator where I work. I didn't even know that that there were other men that was interested in becoming a doulos, right? But now I know the things. I know that men can suffer postpartum depression as women. Mm. I didn't know that. And many of our people don't know those dynamics. So that is to say, when the woman is impregnated and she's starting to form this entity inside of herself, with herself, through herself, she's susceptible to all the different vibrations that is coming from all the different places. And the man has to be the shield to make sure that she is protected, to make sure, not just physically, but emotionally, and certainly even financially. The man has to be the shield to shield everything off that could interfere with the development of that embryo, of that child. I went through a long process these last 2 years. I'll just say it started with the question, what should I do to reduce the negative impact of historical trauma on our youth? And it ended with me working as a fatherhood coordinator. And the answer is right there from the very beginning of that embryo. So the father has to be the one to start to study. What does socio-emotional growth look like in a child? What are the things we should expect from a six-month-old, from a year-old, from a two-year-old? We need to know these things. So the role of the father, particularly in terms of pregnancy, in terms of birth, in terms of postpartum, and postpartum usually goes up to about 2 years. We as men, as fathers, have to study that. And when we study it, we have to pass it on to our sons, that knowledge. We have to pass it on to our nephews. We have to pass it on to any brother who is willing to listen, because we are building ourselves up again. And it was, see, when there was the war that was waged against us, yes, first it was a military war, but the second was a psychological and spiritual war. And then, of course, that would bust up the family. So we are really responding to the war that was waged against us. Well, we're going to come back together, just like the brother said, Asara, Aset, Haru. Right? We're pulling ourselves together. That's the spirit of Wahine Misu. When we are coming together, we're having these conversations, and we're able to say our errors. If you look at further past generations, they weren't too eager to expose their contradictions, right? We at a point now where we can expose those contradictions, and we are willing to share that with the younger people, because we don't have to stand on an ego stand like I'm older or I'm this, I'm that, so therefore I have to be right, so therefore I'm not going to say what really happened. No, we have to say what happened to us, so we can be truthful and transparent to our younger sons, so that they can be the same in their families. Mm-hmm. So that first period, you have to be a student. You have to be educated, and you have to be protector of your wife during that period, because she is actually bringing not only that child into life, into the world, but she's actually creating all that's going to go inside of him or her because of what she's feeling. So mm-hmm. I'll close by saying this. There's a science called epigenetics. Epigenetics says that you can pass down trauma, particularly group trauma, from one generation to the next. And if it's not interrupted, it's going to continue to be passed. So our generation now is saying, oh, we understand the science of epigenetics. It's nature and it's nurture together. And because we're understanding that as a social worker, we're taught to understand human behavior in the social environment, but it's the biological, social, economic, political, historical environment. We are bringing these things into focus as we're talking about the inequity in terms of Black women die three times the rate as white women giving birth. And it's around the same in terms of infant mortality. So we are fighting to make sure that we understand that all of that's coming from oppression. Studies have been shown that African women coming from Africa come to the United States, they have a very high rate of successful birth. They stay in this country 10 years, then they start to mimic the same level of infant mortality and maternal mortality as the Black woman here in America. It's showing that environment is the thing that's making all these problems for us. And it's the father's role during this period to start to study, learn those things, and teach those things.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji, man. We'll get back to resources to study, too, before we end today. But Mr. Ali, if you could share with us what we do with our children once they get past that initial phase and we're into the children stage, what do we do with our children?
All right. First, you know, I want to keep the conversation in context of the reality that's happening today. When you're dealing with the womb, I mean, I've never seen anything like this where babies are being shot in the womb. So when we talk about Black fatherhood and Black collectivity and Black consciousness and fatherhood consciousness, we got to protect the womb. We have to protect the woman and the womb, because brothers, people that look like us, I'm not talking about a policeman, I'm talking about somebody in our community, are taking guns and shooting. And some of the people that's doing it, that's their fiance. At one time, you had to say, I loved you, in order for that baby to be born, unless it happened forcefully. But I know there was a courtship, there was a baby, and then something goes wrong before the baby even gets here. I'm talking about that alignment and that balance. Before the baby even gets here, and the dude says, well, I'm gonna blow you away, and the baby that I planted the seed in you, I'm blowing everybody away. So let's keep in mind that this is going on. You know, this is the violence that that stands against us having families. And when we say families, we talk about a network of family, because my family and your family and Shamari's family and your family should be tight because we have the same values. So once you pass that womb and infancy, then you deal with the child. So again, my family, I started raising my family at a later age too. I might have been 30 or after that. But it wasn't young, it wasn't 18, it wasn't in my early 20s, but it was around 30. So again, I had to reflect on my wife. You know, these are the things that I need you to do in order for our family to be tight. And I said, well, what is that? You know, you gotta support the children at school. You gotta take the children with you. Are you going down to Penn's Landing to the African festival? Take the children with you. Let's do things as a family. So that's what I did. Because what we do, we have a tendency to, we might be with the children when they're young, but when they're teenagers, we say, okay, go on out there and fend for yourself. To me, that don't work today. That don't work today at all. Just a couple of weeks, just this week, there were three youths who got out of school, high school, 17, 15, and 16. And three of them were shot. Three were shot at the same time. Well, we can't let them go like that. We cannot let them go like that. For example, my son is he's a musician. And then in that group, you know, they call them band parents. Or if they're in the basketball, they're basketball parents. But their parents and their fathers are with them throughout childhood. If they see a talent in their child, they bring the talent out, and then they support that child by being with that child in leagues, in bands, and it's never ending. You can't say, well, I'm tired. You know, it was never ending for me until my son was an adult, and then he entered college. Now he's on his own. But from the time that he was born up until the time of 18, I was with him. I introduced him to the people that I knew, to all the musicians that I knew in Philly. I said, son, this is Byard Lancaster. Byard Lancaster, this is my son. They gave him a key. They said, oh, this is your son? Well, tell him he can come on stage and jam with me. People in the audience got on me and said, well, I don't like it. I didn't pay to hear your son play. Your son's not a professional. But Byron Lancaster let him come on stage and he got his chops together. So wherever he stepped, they knew him because they knew his father. So when you're with your child, you know, you gotta, yo, this is my son, this is my daughter, this is my grandchild. I want my grandchild to be a storyteller. I gotta try my best to look out for that grandchild because that's my brother's grandchild. So we've got to be with that child through their endeavors so they won't stray into the street. When we're with them, you know, when do they start getting into the street? When the father backs up and they say, well, my father ain't here, so I'm going to use little, you know, Big Jimmy down here as a role model for fatherhood. And Big Jimmy don't make it because that leads to destruction and self-destruction. You got to be with your children. Model, if they're girls and if they want to be models, they got to do that. If they want to be artists, go with them to the art class until they get their feet, grow their feet, and they can move on without being persuaded by anything else that's out here that leads to our self-destruction, both individually and as a village.
Appreciate that, Pop Pop. Be with them 24/7, man. I hear that, man, because we just live in just a crazy environment that will literally take your children if you don't take them, you know? So I definitely hear that. All right, now we're looking into the teen years. Brother Shamar, walk us through the teen years into adulthood.
Can I get the latter teen years? Because the early teen years, man, I wish we could literally have what Dr. Onaji said earlier. We were doing a baton and the pass off. I think we should have pass off parenting, to be honest with you. I think people should parent in the segment that they're best equipped at. Like y'all got had her early years. I don't know what to do, you know, in them early years. You give me, I'll take over when somebody turns 16 to 24. I got you. But that's when I know what to do there. But from 0 to 16, we got to have relay race parenting. And I'm saying this as a joke, but I really think that, you know, what's the song? What's the poet that says your children are not Khalil Gibran, I think. Your children are not your children. Like, so we got to, okay, I know I birthed this child, but here you go, because this is not my forte. I'll take them back or take her back when they turn 16. And that's when I know what to do. And I think that's when the seriousness of the rites of passage process really kicks in. And I think that, you know, we look at rites of passage as a program over here. Everybody talks about a rites of passage program. But I think that, you know, we got to return rites of passage as the core of how we parent. And I think that at this particular age group that you gave me, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if we're dealing with particularly boys and, you know, modeling is important. We learn by social modeling. That's why it's called social learning theory. You know, I think that, you know, in this point, it's important to teach ourselves or reteach ourselves that we actually know how to parent and we know the rudiments of parent-child attachment, and that parenting for us as African descended people is a core part of the definition of you being a man. Like, you don't just get the, you know, it don't stop because you planted a seed. Like, you know, there's this book I'm familiar with, and I don't know how easy it is to get, but it's called Dismantling Black Manhood by Daniel P. Black, a historical and literary analysis of the legacy of slavery. What I like about the book is before he talks about how manhood was dismantled before we got here, the first few chapters go back and talk about the definition of manhood in a West African context before enslavement and before colonization. And I think we have to understand that for us, this idea that you could be absent as a father, or this idea that there are no rules to how you plant your seed, is something that was imposed on us here as a part of the enslavement and colonization process. It's not how we identify manhood as African people. And so that rites of passage process is a process that has to become context specific to reinforce and reinstill the roles, I call it the four M's, the marital, the material, the monetary, and the martial roles of manhood. And your rites of passage process has to make that valuable. We have to make that cool again. This culture has literally made the antithesis of each of those the standard of being a Black male. So brothers, most of the guys I deal with and my age and younger don't even have becoming married as a goal. Mm. Like I remember when I was little, you would at least still hear men say they want to become married. They want to become a father. You know, they want to be the earner. Now you got brothers who look at manhood as being able to have the woman in their lives take care of them. It's an inversion of what we would esteem as manhood. Or this idea that you don't have the responsibility for protection because, you know, everybody should share it. Nah, bro, you're the martial authority in the context that we find ourselves in. But when you have a culture that's chased us away from those as noble, this idea that if we protect ourselves, somehow that's a sin. You know, you're supposed to just bow down and be as nonviolent as possible and let your oppressor run over you. So these very things that were the core part of our rites of passage process from an African context, you know, the marital role. Yeah, I mean, we come from a people who, until you were deemed by the village as a man, you couldn't have sex.
Mm.
You can't, if you don't make it through the rites of passage process, you were kind of like, yo, that dude is a pariah. He's not worthy of even mating with anyone. That's who we were as a people. So much so that when we look at this culture, their whole parent-child, early childhood education system, you know, we talk about attachment theory. All of that, you know, they credit it to this guy named John Bowlby. One of his key students was a lady named Mary Ainsworth. All of her attachment theory, all of the science underneath it that then goes into pre-K, early childhood education, all of that came from her studying the parent-child relationships in Uganda and other parts of Africa. So all of the science that they use was based on observing that somebody had said it earlier, I think it's Dr. Onaji, the strength of the mother-child, parent-child, village-child attachment that was definitional across all of our African cultures to the extent that our non-urbanized African cultures is the fundamental science underneath how they do effective parent-child education. And that's what we have to reinstitute into our young people, particularly at the age where the potentiality of becoming a parent, because you've gone through adolescence and puberty, the potentiality of becoming a parent and the responsibility, we're not teaching, the media is not teaching it anywhere. The schools are not teaching it. We're not teaching it in church. We're not teaching it at the dinner table. So for me, that is what we would have to do to reinstill this idea of becoming a parent has to become common knowledge and common practice amongst our people again.
Mm. Well said, Brother Shamari, man. I can't imagine what we would have if you had to wait until that rite of passage before having sex, man, like what the village would look like, man. So thank you for painting that in. I know Dr. Onaji wanted to add into the rite of passage as well before we get into questions and everything. Dr. Onaji, did you want to add?
Yeah, Amos Wilson said that we must turn the world right side up because it's upside down, which is true. So growing up as a young man, the two very clear rites of passage was having sex and using drugs. That was, you had to do that. If you was going, I was raised in Harlem, Englewood, New Jersey as well. You had to do that if you wanted to be considered a man or a young man at that point. But now we have to flip it, right? We have to turn the world upside down and say, no, that's not what we need to be doing. We need to bring in, as Baba Nasheed said, we have to bring in the values. right? We have to bring in the distinction. Is sex under the category of family or sex under the category of recreation? Because that what we find is that so many of our young people are moving towards, you know, the recreation part, of course, but we have to also understand that's a response, that's a reaction to oppression, not a response. A response to oppression will be to continue to build strong families, to build strong communities. So how do we help our people deal with oppression and not use all of the trinkets and the different ways that we get addicted in society? So that starts at a very young age, you know, and we can't leave out diet from this conversation. What are we eating, right? The pesticides, the herbicides, how it's our children, you know, our girls are having menses at 9 years old, right? So we have to look at the diet because we can't control what you put in our mouth. We can't control that. I know there's things called food deserts, but still, you still have a control of what you put in your mouth and however long a distance you have to go to get the right food. So it starts with the diet. You know, and that's the physical diet and the mental diet.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji. All right, we are ready for some questions from the audience. If you have a question, you can go to the reaction section and raise your hand. Also, you know, we are talking about Black fatherhood. If you want to share an experience or share something that will aid in the conversation, you can as well. So you could raise your hand in the reaction section and share your question or your thoughts.
Well, I mean, let's start with the obvious. Do you gentlemen think that we start? First of all, let me say this: we don't have a blueprint for fatherhood. No one taught us. We saw different things, and we applied what we saw that we thought fit, and you know, go from there. But there is no book, there is no blueprint for it for us to do this. Don't you guys think that self-esteem is probably the first thing that we should start with in terms of anything we do? He talked about diet for a moment. In terms of all of that, do you think that we need to start with self-esteem, building that from jump?
Can you define what you mean by self-esteem?
Well, here's what I noticed with my child. As soon as she went to school, and that was the biggest mistake I've ever made in my life, was sending her to them. That was a bad move because it became a power struggle. And I saw her esteem wavering at certain junctures in school and simple stuff. My daughter calls me Poppy. They told her that your father is not your Poppy. He's your father. So Black. Now here's the trauma. Father's Day, she writes Happy Father's Day. When she gets home, she crosses it out and puts Poppy on top of it. That's the trauma, you know, right there in her head. You're talking about an 8-year-old girl now. She's going back and forth now in her head because they've told her something and I've told her something, you know, something different. So she's doing this. And I think that it took a lot away from her self-esteem when I sent her to the slave ship. I should have never have done it. And I wish, you know, I wish I never did. You know, I thought that I could combat any racism in the school district by the stuff that I was doing in the afternoon and after school. And I was wrong. I was sorely wrong about that. And I saw her esteem waning. So by 13, I was on a full-out assault on it. And then I was still battling mom and grandma, because mom and grandma was saying, you can't pull her out of school. You can't do that. And my simple question was, why? And it took me a while to get her in the mold where, it took me 3 years to get in the mold where her self-esteem was where it should be. But I think that, like, I have children now in different, different programs in schools, and I deal with the schools, and I coach basketball, and I see that whole self-esteem thing. When I coach the 5 and 6-year-old, when I give them that esteem, it's a lot easier for them to digest the information that I need to give to them in terms of this. But when I get them at 8 and 9 and I first get them, I can't tell them anything, anything. And then when I get them at 16, I got to break it all down and then build them back up, because there is no esteem at that point. You know, I can look at them and tell, we can, a couple of sentences and I'll know where that child is and I'll know what I need to do to break that down. And the other thing was interesting to me is I can't get black boys to look me in the eye. I can't get them to look me in the eye. They look, they turn away. They can't give me a steady gaze. I was talking to a friend of mine about this yesterday. He had some kid, he works in Brooklyn. He has some kids and he said the same thing. They won't, black boys won't look you in the eye. And I don't know if it's because they're not used to it. They will not hold a gaze with you at all.
About 15 years ago, because time flies, we did this book called Why Children Hate Us, me and my brother, Butch Slaughter. And the subtitle is How Black Adults Betray Black Children. And one of the things I find is to try to answer your question, because I've been struggling with that question. And I used to think it was that simple. Teach our culture, you know, raise the self-esteem, show people how great we used to be, and voila! Nah, it don't work like that. Because one of the things I find is that I think that that's necessary, so I'm not dismissing it, but it has to go with, so on the topic of fatherhood, one of the things I find, and I don't want to speak for anybody else because I'm sure other people might disagree with me, we don't believe in the authority or the power or the reverence of black manhood and black fatherhood as a people anymore. We don't believe in it. We're losing the belief in it as it relates to black motherhood. That authority was conditioned in us very strongly. The mother is the backbone of the family, like that. Affirmation of the power of the black woman has been reified in this culture, but Papa in this culture has always been a rolling stone, right? So that's why I was talking earlier about the rites of passage. And when you have a culture that's structured around the sanctity of these roles versus us having centuries of oppression and an oppression that's centered around the idea that you as a Baba have no authority. We're in this situation because you're broken. We broke you such that we can exploit the women and the children, right? And so even for me, self-esteem, if that's the thing we gotta do, it's not for the children. We have to esteem ourselves as mamas and babas again, and our children will derive their self-esteem when they re-esteem who we are. See, the crisis we have, and that's with the young people I deal with, is not their belief in their own self-esteem, because many of these fools think they're the greatest thing that ever walked on earth, but they have no esteem for their parents. They have no esteem for the elders. They have no esteem for African culture. They have no esteem for Black culture. They have no belief that we can do anything about the situation that they're in, because we send them to these piss poor schools every day. We tell them, we give them messages that says, we have no authority. We're not your mama. We're not your baba. Bow down to Joe Biden. Or bow down to some other force or entity that is beyond us. And so the self-esteem has to be connected to a re-esteeming that we as the adults in the village have to do. And we have to do that because our children's self-esteem is contingent on their belief in who we are as their mamas and babas. If you raise up a child to esteem him or herself and they have no regard for the adult authority in their community, we get the turmoil that we have now. Because trust me, these children out here, they're not suffering from self-esteem. It's that they have learned to esteem themselves at the expense of everybody else. And that's the trick this culture has played on us. And that's what we have to resurrect and undo and reinvert, because that's where we're losing the battle. We have children who literally believe that their needs and their impulses and their wants supersedes everything else that happens in the village. They're not suffering from esteem. They're suffering from a sense of cultural grounding, obligation, and the belief that we as a community and as their mamas and babas are worthy of their submission.
But isn't that sort of the same thing in terms of teaching self-esteem? You teach them the history. You teach them how things are supposed to be. You teach them how things are supposed to go. Now, we've done a terrible job of doing that. Our generation and the generation before that, we didn't do such a great job. We did it in pockets. But isn't it the same thing? If I'm teaching my daughter esteem and self-esteem, I'm teaching her how things are supposed to go. The respect that she has for her elders. This is how things are supposed to go. This is how things work. But this is how things are supposed to work. Isn't it the same thing?
No, because if you teach her that, but the people who she's under authority to don't have it and don't esteem themselves, it's going to come back and become a competition. That's the whole ideology that's underneath people who can say, they're before the grace of God, go I. Or this idea that I'm going to do good and leave the hood, right? So you set up, because you got to collectivize this thing. And so what we do often is we individualize our interventions, but what is sick is not us as African individuals. We are sick as a village. So everything we do, the modality has to be towards the collective healing of the village. So I'm not saying we don't do self-esteem. I'm just saying our self-esteem intervention can't just be directed at the children. It has to incorporate the whole of our village or else it's going to fall short. That's all I would say.
Gotcha. I'm trying to swallow that.
I know. When I wrote the Why Our Children Hate Us, we believe that the key was going after and just really raising the esteem and challenging the parents to lift. What I found 15 years later is our parents and Black adults don't believe in ourselves. That's why we can hand our children over to our enemies to educate, to do whatever they want to, because we don't believe, we don't have the esteem in our own authority to say, nah, this is who we are. We're going to homeschool. We're going to do whatever we have to do to make sure that we don't hand our children to a devouring enemy. We don't esteem our own authority, and yet we want our children to act in an alignment that we have not yet modeled for ourselves.
Well, isn't that kind of the whole point again, is that we stop it. We stop the ebb and flow with us. We understand there's certain amount of people out there who do, Black people, who do understand the system and what's happening with the system. So we take that, we stop that with the babies, that next generation of babies, because we've gotten ourselves together in that regard. Not the organic whole, but just us in general, like you said, pockets. That's what it is right now. It's pockets of people who understand. That's who I align my daughter with, those pockets of people who knew what time it was and who were doing what they were supposed to do. And so if we take those kids and we have this line, we stopped right here. And all those kids have esteem. They understand what should be done in motherhood and in fatherhood. And as they grow, we keep that inside of them. Isn't that where we start at?
Yeah, but let somebody else jump in. I don't want to go back and forth.
Yes, sir.
Just
to clarify, I think both of you are kind of saying the same thing. And I think that what Brother Shamari is saying is that as long as we do it to ourselves first before we give it to our children, then it should work. And what Professor Robinson is just saying is that we need to give our children the self-esteem. I think you both are agreeing. But what Brother Shamari is saying, that as long as we have it ourselves first, then we should be able to distribute it amongst our children. So I think you both are agreeing.
Yeah, can I just add one more thing to clarify what I'm saying? I'm saying self-esteem comes through work. We have to start winning the liberation struggles that we're in, and our children see us winning, then they get self-esteem. It's not something I could pull my child off in a corner and teach them, and then they go out and shithole communities and shithole families. We can't do that. We have to win liberation battles, and our children see us win, then they get self-esteem. We can't skip over that. That's really what I'm saying. I want to be clear.
That's very difficult, brother. I know we're going back and forth, and I apologize, but that's very difficult because we're still wounded warriors here. We still suffer from trauma. The trauma, how many brothers you know suffer from not having their fathers there? not understanding, not knowing what to do, making it up as they go along. I'm saying the brothers who do know, we collectively grab them and we have a collective front and we say, this is what we're teaching the next generation, whether it's my biological or not, we teach them this so they can go on to the next level. And they see us teaching this. And that's the winning part. That's the winning part. That's where they've won at, because they saw us and they come back to us, because that's how I learned. And they come back to us and they tell us, they reinforce it. And then they go and they start teaching the next children. That's where we go. And we leave this educational system alone, because that's the problem. That's making these other people, that educational system is killing us right now. That's all I'm trying to say. So I guess we're saying the same thing.
Yes, sir. I think King had something and then Ty has his hands up. So King, you had something?
All right. I was saying, like, basically you kind of said what I was going to say, that they really kind of have the same point. I think it's application is where they kind of differ in terms of how to, you know, effectively make that process, you know, something that could be fruitful and prosper more children to be like that. Because I know Paul personally, I know, as far as, you know, in terms of self-esteem, he definitely, you know, that was like a main asset that he was trying to instill in his children and the children that was around him. But like the other thing is, when you go into those buildings, like it's a battleground. You know, I remember being in high school myself, like, you know, my mother always like, yo, Whitey ain't this, Whitey ain't that. But I go in there and all I'm doing is stuck with dealing with Whitey. And I'm like, well, what do I do? What do I do? And how do I figure, how do I navigate through this? And then, you know, all your friends are looking at you like, you know, we doing this over here, some doing that over there, and ain't none of it like beneficial to you, but you kind of like gravitate towards whatever type of vibe that is safe, basically, whatever gets you through the day. Then you got to come home and you bringing all of that negativity back to the house, and you basically instilling that same ignorance into your little brothers and sisters, you know. So I understand the self-esteem, and I understand what the other brother is saying with the, you know, that the community is kind of, and I think that's what it is. The community is kind of broken in terms of, you know, we say it takes a community to raise a child, but the community is having some real issues right now. So when you put your child out into that community, like, what education are they getting? You know, are we all aligned in terms of, you know, making sure that child, his child, my child is all, you know, moving towards progress, you know, collectively and healthily, which is right now, it's very sketchy. You know, when I send my kids out the door, it's basically, I hope they come back. So I get the self-esteem, and it's very important. But yeah, I guess I would say the parent need to have that kind of self-esteem that, you know, they need to know that when they put that book bag on and they carrying everything, that they got to be strong enough to do it. And some aren't. Some hope they are, and some aren't. And we're all trying to work through that process.
Yeah, he said what I was trying to say in a much, much clearer way. Because I was saying that the self-esteem without our intervention and protection just puts a bullseye on our children's backs in the areas that they have to navigate. And so if with the self-esteem, there's also a call to protection and village building that has to go with that. My challenge is that most of what I see under the auspices of Afrocentricity and African culture is this restoration and reaffirmation of self-esteem mantras. And we did this and we are kings or queens, but nobody's doing the Kazi, the work that says, now that I've done that for my little ones, my Watoto, I am now obligated to those four M's I talked about. I came up in an independent school. I taught in independent schools, man. And the problem we had those children, and they were the most self-esteem, beautiful children up until eighth grade. But because we didn't institution build and had the high school for those children to go to, when they went back out there into the village, they got slaughtered, literally. Mm-hmm. And I mean, physically, mentally, emotionally, because again, that self-esteem, we also had that's a call to us as a village to create the array of protections around our children, such that we could then do what the brother Paul is saying. We can have the circles, we can have the homeschooling networks, we can have the collective buying clubs and the Ujamaa circles and all of that stuff that's necessary to, for our children to see, okay, there's a village that I've actually been raised into. And often we only do one without doing the other.
Yeah, it's very hard to incorporate that stuff. I mean, I've seen, and I know that village exists because I've seen it. My kids have been through it. Paul's kids have been through it. But, you know, it took a long time to have a tightly wound network. So where, you know, when you send your child to, you know, a person's house, that they're going to be getting the same thing that they would get at my house and vice versa. If they send their children to me, they're going to be getting the same protection and education and information that I have. As I know that if I send my children to them, it's going to be the same thing. But, you know, outside of that bubble that we kind of created, you know, it's still hard. It was hard for us even creating it to be, you know, to be able to, like, you know, keep your head high every day. Sometimes it's like, you just drop your shoulders like that.
All of what was said is certainly very helpful and instructive. I'll add to that, if you look at what is called the COINTEL program, for those who might are hearing this for the first time, it's called the Counterintelligence Program that Hoover started with the intent to make sure that a Black Messiah would not rise up from our communities, not a Malcolm nor a Martin. And I'm bringing that up to say that when we start to say that we failed as a generation, we're not taking into consideration the war that was exacted against us. You can't talk about the consequence without talking about the cause. You have to talk about the cause and the consequence if you're going to have a balanced understanding of really what took place. So our task is, how do we define phenomena? How do we define reality? And that in that defining is bringing all the aspects of the things that have happened. So we have to raise up to our children. The brother just said he was part of the independent schools. I was a teacher in Yudhusasa in New York. In fact, I knew Sister Nalo in Philadelphia was a very good friend of mine. So I know the national struggle that we did for independent schools under the banner of CBU, Council for Independent Black Institutions. And we need to study that, and we need to bring them together. So we can't be so quick to say what we don't have. I want you to remember that when Mr. G started the show, he said Black fathers spend more time with their children than any other group. Most of us don't know that. The study was done, and it said we spend more time with our children than everyone else. Who is the absentee father? Certainly is those so-called slave masters, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to continue to build from a strong point of view. That I'm not saying absence of criticism or observation, but we have to start on a strength-based approach. Right. So it's not only understanding historical trauma, we have to understand historical resilience and historical resistance as well. Once we are fully knowledgeable about those things, you can see. Last week, I saw this 7-year-old boy present himself in such a self-assured and self-confident manner that I was just in total awe. In fact, I was told that he was at a meeting with some other adults either that day or the day before. And every time after he spoke, the adults didn't want to speak after the boy because he had so much wisdom. And he wasn't speaking from like a question. Like, isn't this, he was speaking authority. He said, no, you can't. This is the words he was using. You can't expect a certain kind of behavior if their consciousness is not there. The people have to have the consciousness first. And that can only come when we're working together with, you know, collective values. I'm like 7 years old. Mm-hmm. So we have to identify our strength, right? And put that forward. So yes, there was unity, criticism, unity. Yes, we can also have unity, healing, unity, right? We have to now, all the things we've been exposed to, now is the time to bring them all to the table. What you got? I got the Guzu Sab, I got the seven bishops. But what you got? Well, I got Islam, but what you got? You know, I got whatever it is, right? And then we decide, okay, what things are we going to use in this circle, right? In my family, what circle in my community? Because our challenge, this is our greatest challenge. There are some phenomenal Black men in many political arenas, But what we have to do is we have to solve the question of cultural and political pluralism amongst ourselves. We solve that. In mathematics, that's called solving a system of simultaneous equations. You have the same, you have the same number of independent equations as you do variables, and you solve them all at the same time. When we create political and cultural pluralism amongst ourselves and affirm that any right, that anything that a Black man wants, we are going to affirm his right to that, as you must also affirm my right to what I want, be it the five states in the Republic of New Africa, or be it the citizens of the United States, or if you want to repatriate someplace else. If we're talking about manhood, we're talking about nationhood, because you can't separate the two. If you talk about nationhood, you're talking about the question of sovereignty. If you're talking about sovereignty, you're talking about the question of self-determination. And I'm going to end with, you know, Malcolm X. Malcolm X says we have to think as people, you know, we have to know what's happening in the Congo just as much what is happening down in Mississippi. And he said, it's not a question of civil rights, it's a question of human rights. What he was saying to us is that look to the places where the highest level of thinking has taken place, where people can resolve their contradictions, their conflicts. And now we have with the United Nations, the World Conference on Racism, excuse me, we have the Decade for People of African Descent that deals with recognition, deals with justice, and also development. We have the permanent form of the people of African descent. So the point I'm making that manhood has to be tied to familyhood, nationhood, has to be tied to the international world, and then we can start to make those kinds of connections. Because with the permanent form for African people of African descent, these are the issues that are now being heard on the first time on the international level to the degree that's being heard. And that goes to the question of plebiscite. We cannot be men if we don't demand a nation. And the only way we can demand a nation is that we have to have a vote. That vote is called the plebiscite. When we grow the political consciousness in our people that we have a right to a plebiscite, then the whole world can come and help us, but they can't help us until we help ourselves. It's called jus orator. We have to demand the right that is already there, but we have to demand it. And that's a question of political education that I was taught by Imari Obadeli. So once we demand a plebiscite, a vote, the world can be able to help us. Every revolutionary movement in the world, they didn't win the revolutions by themselves, just in their own physical geopolitical location. They had resources coming from other places. And the only way that we can get the resources, the same way those people over there is getting those resources, is that we have to claim ourselves to be a nation. We're not a state, but we have to claim ourselves as being a nation. And that's according to the Declaration of Minorities. We have something what is called the national minority that gives us the right. You want to keep your American citizen? You can do that. But you can also claim the right to group human rights, which is through what is called the Declaration of Minorities, what is called the National Minority. So we can use the work of Yusuf Dr. Clyde, KLY, and we can demand that. But we have to come and demand a plebiscite. Without the plebiscite, there's no notion of a nation, because we haven't grown and demonstrated the political consciousness to say this is what I'm declaring.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji. We had Ty waiting patiently for a long time, man.
I kind of lost my frame of thought because I was sponging that in. But, you know, I agree on some of these fronts. But, you know, like Onaji first said, when we first came in, they have to want to hear the stuff. You know what I mean? And sometimes it falls on deaf ears with these youngsters. They, like you said, they're confident in themselves. But once they hear certain things, they could just be shunned from it. Everybody don't get it at the same time. That's why I just want to reincorporate. And it's a confidence building thing. Esteem is confidence. If we go at them with the confidence and they see you moving in your community a certain way, they will gravitate towards you. I just want to put that.
I agree.
Appreciate that, Ty. Appreciate that. We had Hashim. Hashim had his hand up.
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to say, you know, first give you a lot of respect and props for putting this thing together. You know, and all of the brothers who took the time out to be here this afternoon, this evening. You know, I remember back in 95, I went to the Million Man March. I was like 19 or whatever. And that was like a real game changer for me, you know, to go to DC and be with brothers from all over the country out there in Washington. And I was really, really inspired from that. And one of the things that I recall from that movement of that day was the love. You could feel the love in the air, you know? And I had never experienced anything like that, you know? And so, except, you know, if you went to like a cookout or a barbecue or something, but to be with total strangers, Black men all over the country, it was powerful. And so one of the things that, you know, the charge was after everybody left, it was like, listen, now when y'all all leave, go back out into your communities and make a difference, you know? And so that was 95 for me. And ever since then, I've been doing, you know, a lot of mentoring since 95. And I do that up until this very day. And over the years, one thing has stayed the same that I've noticed with young people is that consistency is everything. You know, when young people see that you are consistent, they respect that, you know? And so what I've also noticed is love. You know, when they know that you genuinely love them, they know that you genuinely care for them, it trumps titles, it trumps everything. When they know that you are genuinely gonna be there, that they can count on you, that you are going to love them in spite of the pushback that they initially give you, and you understand where that source is coming from, they always just appreciate it. But one of the things I just wanted to really kind of throw out there is that there's been a change that I've noticed over the last 5 or 10 years, and that has been suicides on the rise in our community with a lot of young Black males. And that was something that I never saw. Like I said, I've been doing this for almost 30 years now. I've never seen that. You know, that was always like another community. That wasn't us. But the suicides on the rise isn't just for our young people, but, you know, all throughout the country. And so I think with the advancements in technology, like with social media and all of these different kind of platforms, the internet of things, we'll just call it, not just social media, but the internet, you know, being able to Google and the YouTube and all of that, it's working to our advantage, like this platform right here today, right? Use the internet to communicate, but also it's a disadvantage. And so part of what I'm noticing is that, you know, say for instance, last year, you know, they had that riot on Capitol Hill and they told Donald Trump, listen, you can't be on Twitter because you're inciting problems. And I found it interesting how they could remove the president from using social media, but they won't stop our young, they will still allow these record companies to promote the violence and the sexuals and all of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it's just that reminder of the attacks that our young people are under, you know? And it's systematic. So when the brother talked about the COINTEL program, we don't know in the midst of when Hoover was doing what he was doing, we didn't know about COINTEL until years and years later. We will never know the attacks that are being permeated on our communities right now until 20 and 30 years later, the real attacks, you know? And so when they allow the young people to listen to the music that's saying, you know, like in the Bronx right now, it's going crazy. Kids is killing at an all-time high out there. And they using certain kind of music to just fuel it. And so I'm saying that to just say, like, you know, we can never forget the attacks that we are constantly under. And so we know about it in the school system. And so I think, you know, we just have to be reminded that there is a reason why they're attacking us in the manner that we do, that they have been for the last 300 years since we've been in this country. And, you know, as we talk about generational wealth and we talk about bitcoins and currency and all of that, we can't forget about the generational trauma that has been passed down, you know? And so as we know about the generational trauma, we also know that our ancestors left us some components on how to deal with the attacks, you know? So we have to learn how to sift through the things that we need to let go, and we have to retain the things and the strengths that they taught us, you know? And unfortunately, you know, some of that is beginning to get lost, but I think it's on our shoulders to continue to get that message out. So again, I'll close as I open. You know, P, I give you a lot of respect. Anytime you say, listen, I'm doing something, I'm always trying to be there for you because I respect what you do and, you know, bringing all of these good people together. And so again, just stay strong and, you know, never lose hope, brothers, because what we're doing, we are definitely making an impact. And as long as we don't, you know, because the babies might lose hope, but as long as we don't lose hope, you know, then we'll be in a good place.
I've seen you hit it, man. You definitely was hitting it. Because I hadn't wanted to bring up that point about the war. I wanted to make the parallel. So thank you for picking that up and bringing that in. So it goes back to us just affirming who we are. You know, we can't belittle ourselves so much where we, you know, we ain't in the game. We got to stay in the game. I put it in the chat for those who've had a chance to see this thing called Be a Strong Family. I'm doing some work with that organization out of Chicago. And it's a conversation. Where do we start? We start with having simple conversations around what it is to be a father, a mother, a parent. And the way it's structured, it's no place for blame, for shame, or any kind of criticism. People just kind of have their own space, but it's in a structured way. So I'm looking for people who want to get trained in it, because the more parent cafes and the more dad cafes that we put together, the greater we'll broaden the conversation about relatedness. We'll broaden the conversation about possibility and about the actions that we can take. So we're on the move. We just have to just keep on, you know, keep on circling up, and we're going to get this done, because our people got us here for us to do what we got to do for this generation so we can pass it on to the next. Keep circling up, people. Keep circling up.
Appreciate that, Dr. Onaji. I kind of want to get this in before we wrap up. I think one of our greatest conflicts, again, is with our Black mothers sometimes. And for whatever reason that the relationship falls apart, there is a huge amount of difficulty. And I know a lot of Black fathers that just struggle to balance the relationship with the Black mother and come to some sort of understanding, some sort of agreement, some sort of, you know, reasoning to co-parent. And so what I'm asking you all is, how do we formulate, you know, a social contract with our Black mothers, even when it doesn't work out and we don't necessarily get along? How do we figure out how to focus in on the children and not have the children suffer a great deal when things don't work out? So, you know, whoever wants to tackle that.
You know, this is unnatural. So in my work, I look that I have three types of fathers. Maybe four types. One father who's not really involved with their children at all, okay? We have fathers who are singly raising their child, right? Another father who is actually with the mother, in some cases mothers, in healthy relationships. And then there's the other one who is not involved with the mother, wants to be involved with the child. So the work that we have to do is provide a type of response to each one of those situations. So in fatherhood in general, most of the literature is geared towards supposedly the father and the mother that are kind of together. How do they work it out? But there are a lot of Black organizations which is coming up that are saying, no, we have to address the realities, the subjective realities of what the fathers are in, which means that the kind of discussions and things we have has to pinpoint their particular situation. That's how we can approach that.
Got it. I appreciate that. If anybody else between Brother Shamari and Mr. Ali wanted to chime in with that, just how to communicate with our Black mothers, even when we don't get along, before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the easy answer is that has to happen at the front end of the parenting cycle, you know. But I mean, I think that that's where this village concept comes in, where people feel like or understand that, you know, it's so many things we got to hit on, because I think that, you know, we haven't talked about incarceration and the role that gets played. You know, we hit on, and the brother brought up COINTELPRO, and we hit on this systematic policy structural issues that are designed to eviscerate the Black family. But then we talk about learning about them or coping with them But I guess my major point is, and that's where I started at the early, the beginning, you can't separate fatherhood from warriorhood. So my thing is, we got to bring the warriorhood back to our roles as fathers, because this system is coming for us. They're coming for our family. And whenever we have a conversation about fatherhood, we got to be talking about the Baba talked about the role of the male doula as the protector to bring the emotional stability to alleviate the precarity from the mother as she's giving birth. But that's our role all the way through the life cycle. And so we can't continue to have conversations about fatherhood and not have a call to warriorhood, because our families are being warred against. And I don't want to wait 20 years to look back and understand that, you know, these dynamics of the Internet of Things or incarceration or COINTELPRO were designed to destroy us. We know that now. And so because we know that, there's a call to how we must act in that knowledge. And, you know, if it makes me unpopular, cool, but we as brothers, particularly as fathers, can no longer avoid that. We have to have conversations in circles, but then followed by work that says they are warring against the welfare and the well-being of our families. What do we do about it? And in that context, one of the things we know we must do is maintain our presence with our children by any means necessary, even if that means as we're working, other people are serving in surrogate roles as we're holding up our responsibility. We have designated people in the village who are serving as surrogates to keep the attachment between the mamas and the fathers and the children. Because we are living in a culture that has conditioned us to believe that our presence as fathers is an option. We literally believe that we have been socialized for over a century that there is a role for single mothers, and that's the high role, and that our presence is optional. So we have to do everything that we can to understand that as a family, we are under duress. It's not about women or men or fathers or mothers or elders or children. They're coming for us all. And we have to have a collective response that understands all of that interrelatedness and what our role is as men, as babas, as fathers and warriors, knowing that we are in a state of war. That's clear. There should be no more deliberation about that. They're riding into neighborhoods in Buffalo and taking out who they choose. We know that this is real. What is the call to action as the fathers and the babas of our community that we must man up into? And I think that when our people, our sisters, our children, our elders see us do that work, all of these other things around self-esteem and belief in us, that'll come. But our people right now need to see us man up and step into that role that we need to deliver on behalf of our people. Not just talk about it, but we have to actually go out there and wage war against the people who are proliferating the drill music that the brother was talking about that's conditioning our people to kill themselves. That's a real thing. We got to go out there and be at war with the prison systems that are coming into our communities and stealing babas out of our community. Our children need to see us at war with those systems, not just against what they're doing that's wrong. We got to be at war with the police who are intentionally putting drugs and guns in our communities. These are acts of assault against our people, and our village needs to see us organize locally, regionally, and nationally as men, as fathers, standing up against the real adversaries to Black progress and not necessarily against one another.
Appreciate that. Well said. All right, we haven't heard from Mr. Ali in a good minute. So as we are going to close out, I know, Mr. Ali, what you normally do is you also close out the grounding show for us for radio with Brother Shamari. So I don't know if you have anything to help us close today. But
no, I just want to give my reflections on the conversation.
Yes, sir.
Because the brothers brought up a lot of good points, but I think that we need to get together. Elder fathers need to get together, just like we're doing now, so that we can hear our perceptions of life as it affects the Black family and us. And then once we get that together, we need to reach out to the young fathers, because all of my children are grown. And you had talked about co-parenting. You know, co-parenting is something that I really don't see the effectiveness in that, because it, to me, it disrupts the family the way they do it now. My daughter has two children, and the father of my grandchildren, they're co-parenting. So they may be at my daughter's house Monday to Wednesday, and then they can't get into a routine of success to prepare them for success, because Thursday and Friday, because he's off, they're at his house and they live a far distance. So doing what they do, they got to go from a far distance to there. They're not getting enough sleep. So that co-parenting, and I don't know how that works. But us as a group of Black men need to get together. Then we need to talk to the young brothers and us with the knowledge, because there's a whole bunch of knowledge on this panel. Us with the knowledge, okay, we got the knowledge. We give it to our children. Again, don't let them go out there by themselves. We got to be with them. They might be 17 and 18, but they still under our house, and we got to be with them. They might say, well, Dad, I don't need you with me. Yes, you do. I'm gonna walk with you. I'm gonna walk behind you. I'm gonna walk in front of you. I'm gonna be with you as I push you to where I want you to be and where you want to be. And we want to push our families and our children towards success in whatever endeavor that's good. Nothing that's going to take their life, but we want them to have success. They only going to do that with the Black fathers with them. You got to be with them. You got to be with them.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that, Mr. Ali. Before we close out, we got Ty with his hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to, like, what he said about co-parenting. He's right on that aspect, because I had to deal with that myself. And, you know, the foundation that's built on that, it could be rocky, because you don't, like you say, you have one house at one time and another house at another time. When I want to voice my opinion on something, I have to, like, constrain myself, because I don't pay that rent there. So I kind of agree with him on that standpoint, because that does. But our relationship is good. But, you know, my daughter's successful. She has her own nail business. But at the same time, when I can remember a time where I couldn't really voice how I really feel, because I wasn't in that household with her on a consistent basis. So I kind of agree with him on that.
Man, yeah, it's... I think either way, it's just such a challenge, man. And it all starts with the communication component. And I feel like when you got the mother that's angry and the father that's angry, and they're both bickering and this and that and the third, and the focus is not on the children, it just makes it so much harder to get find that balance. You know what I mean? So I do think we have to figure out how to get to a place where we can communicate effectively, even if we're talking about, you know, counseling, therapy, whatever it is. You know, I think that's important as well, based on what Ty was just saying. All right. So we had just a lot of information today, man. I learned a ton. I appreciate everyone for coming on and joining the conversation. I think these conversations definitely need to continue and expand. And we need to bring in the children into these conversations as well, which we do plan on doing. So they can get their perspectives out and what they need from us. You know, it's one thing to say what we need to do for the kids, but the kids have their own perspective and their own thoughts and their own experiences. So we definitely have to hear what they need from us, and we got to figure out how we can give that to them. So that is on the way. And of course, for the women that were on today, listening in, we got the Black motherhood too. We ain't going to do you like that. So we're going to cover that part as well. So definitely tune in for that. Appreciate everybody for coming on and sharing the information with us. I know I learned a lot, and I could definitely You know, I think everybody on here has learned a lot. Before we close out, Professor Robinson, did you have anything? Any last words?
No, I thought it was very interesting. I think we need to have a part two.
Yes, sir.
That we didn't get to, and I think we can get to. And I'm going to look that brother up so I can continue our dialogue.
Brother Shamar. Uh-oh.
It sounded like a call out. I'm nervous now.
No, don't be nervous.
Yeah. No, I'm just joking, but I talk with a little fervor, but you know, please forgive me. It's not animosity, it's fervor.
Don't take it personal. I don't take it personal at all.
I enjoyed this, and thank you, Mr. G, for having us. I think that these type of conversations, you know, need to be as common as who's going to win the NBA championship arguments and like this is what we should be talking about, whether we talk about it in a mellow space or excitedly, or it doesn't even matter. Like, this is what needs to be common conversation in our circle. So I appreciate you for pulling this together.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. And also, before we close out too, I'd just like to give everybody a chance to share where people can find you and some of the resources that you mentioned on the chats as well. So Dr. Onaji, where can we find you? And what were some of the resources you mentioned where people can get some support?
I put my email in the chat, om@delco, D-E-L-C-O, foundation.org. And be more than happy to share the information I have, you know, different trainings and resources. I would like to say that we're going to have here, and it's going to be on Zoom, a fatherhood summit. And the theme of the summit is fathers play your role in the fatherhood game, right? Last year, the summit theme was get in the fatherhood game. And now we're saying play your role. And the way we're approaching it is that all the speakers are people who embody the very thing they're talking about. So we're not talking theory, we're talking practice. So I'll send that, you know, when people send me their email address after taking down mine, I can send those invitations. So there's some things coming up that I think your listening audience would like to know about and participate in.
Appreciate that, appreciate that. Mr. Ali, where can we find you, man? I know you're on Sundays, Word Radio. Where else can we find you?
Well, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can always contact you. And then on Sundays, I'm on WURD Radio Groundings with Brother Shamari. And you can go to WURDRadio.com and tune in at 6 o'clock on Sundays. And I'm telling stories about our village and our community on there. So you can get in touch with me through you, or you can tune in to WURDRadio.com on Sundays at 6 o'clock.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Brother Shamari, where can we find you?
WURD Radio, 96.1 FM, 900 AM. You can go to the website, www.wurdradio.com, Fridays 1 to 4, and then Sundays 6 to 8. And then starting in June, we're doing another hour focused on the African diaspora called Dynamics of the African Diaspora from 11 p.m. to midnight. Also, you know, we're creating a formation here in Philly called the Baobabas. And it's after the sense of the sturdiness of the baobab tree. And based on the nursery rhyme, you know, that nursery rhyme that says, when the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. And so we have a mantra said, we are the babas, we are the bough, we cannot break. And so we really, somebody talked about earlier, linking up all of our families. And so this is a group of brothers who are coming together as, you know, fathers in their families. And we're going to create our own, you know, some people don't like this word, but tribe, clan, village of mutual support, buying, collective buying, trying to do the things that sometimes we have been convinced that we can no longer do. So, you know, if there's a way that we can link up, I know that you all are in New York, but figuring out virtually how we can kind of mutually support each other. But it's going to be a collective of about 25 unified families that are really going to begin to work together cohesively that under the banner of the Baobabas. And, you know, looking forward to being able to update you all on the formation as that evolves.
Yes, sir. That's going to be all in person?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is, you know, we I, t- I, t- I get in trouble. I tell people all the time, yo, out on the streets, man, these bullets ain't virtual, so our interventions can't be. You know, we gotta be where the reality is.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Man, like Brother Shamari said, Black fatherhood is revolutionary. Let's get information, like Brother Dr. Onanji said. Let's spend time with the children, all our time, all their time, like Mr. Ali said. And let's build their self-esteem, like Professor Robinson said. So we got a lot of work to do, folks. But we are here to support you. Everybody on is here to support you. So definitely look out for those resources if you need. You could hit us up, mrg.mastermind@gmail.com. If you need resources as a Black father, if you're struggling as a Black father and you need some counseling, you know, Dr. Onanji provides that as well. So we got you covered. So definitely tune in to the program, and we will be adding to these conversations. And thank you, everybody, for coming out today. And listeners, thank you. Definitely share the program with other Black fathers. We need this information, and it should be common information, like Brother Shamari just mentioned earlier. And of course, always remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G, and I will see you next time on Mastermind.